This is Hazel Kahn and North Fork Works with my guest, Paul Maffetone, who started Michael's Hope, a nonprofit organization to combat heroin use after his brother Michael died of an overdose in 2012. Welcome first of all to
Thank
my
you.
Program.
Thank you.
So talk about your background a little bit. I know you live in Laurel, is that right?
Yeah, I live in Laurel.
Which is just west of Matatuck,
yep.
for those who don't know. Were you born there?
No, I was born in Woodbridge, Virginia. My brother and I, for the most part, grew up in New Suffolk. We went to the New Suffolk school, little schoolhouse, 12 of us from grades 1 through 6th. Then we moved to Laurel. And that's where I've been ever since.
So then you graduated?
Yeah, from Matatuck High School, 2007.
Oh, then, yeah, see. So what happened in the last
10 years?
Almost,
yeah. You know, graduated high school and with no direction, what it is I wanted to do in life. So just started working. I didn't go to college. I didn't want to be one of those kids that just went to college to go to college and waste all this money and then have to figure out how to pay this money back and with no reason of why I went to college. And I didn't want to go to college for a reason that I thought I might use and then find out after college that I'm not going to use it and have to figure out how to pay all this money back. So I figured I'd just start making money. I ended up getting involved in the winemaking industry after high school. So I made wine for a few years. Yeah, I was the assistant winemaker for a local winery.
Which one?
Waters Crest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was side by side with James Waters, the owner. He taught me a lot. I loved the industry. You know, and then it just progressed from there through different jobs. 2012, February 2012, I lost my brother to a heroin overdose. So that totally changed my whole direction in life on what it is that I felt like my sole purpose was to be here. And that's when I got involved in more community aspects of this heroin epidemic that we're facing. Going to like open floor meetings and programs and events out west.
As a participant or as an observer?
As an observer.
What are you looking for?
Answers.
Why did your brother die?
Yeah, again, my brother wasn't a smoker. My brother wasn't a drinker. You know, he didn't smoke pot. You know, he was in ROTC in high school. So it didn't make any sense to me why he would ever get involved in heroin. I had a lot of rage built up because of the people that were selling heroin to him. The people that knew he was using it and didn't reach out to the family. Friends that were using with him. Friends that claimed that they were clean and that were hanging out with him. That knew he was using. There's just a lot of rage. Sadness, a lot of things were built up that were leading me to these events. I was known as the shoot your local heroin dealer kid at that time because I had a t-shirt. I bought that t-shirt from a company in Ohio.
Nobody else had the t-shirt?
Yeah, nobody else had that t-shirt. I got a lot of bad rap for that t-shirt from some people. Probably wasn't the safest or most secure thing to be walking around in public wearing. Shoot your local heroin dealer. So like I have a t-shirt also that says execute cop killers that I wear. So I'm very open with my feelings. And I like to make statements. That's what I was known as at these events. But then I started seeing what these people were doing. And then I started seeing young people that were involved from other states and things like that. And I felt that there wasn't anything substantial here on Long Island and that there needed to be. So I had gotten involved with an organization outside of Jersey. And I was going to be the one that did the Long Island part for him while he traveled the country and did other things, but I felt that I wanted to do it on my own and that there was possibly a way to do it on my own. Like I said, it started off with me going to events and getting my name out there, and even if nobody knew my name, they knew of me because of my t-shirt. So it started with that, and then I started selling and handing out rubber bracelets that said I hate heroin on them.
Is that your phrase?
No, I can't say that I own that phrase. It was actually a woman from Wisconsin that was saying, I hate heroin. We had linked over Facebook and she saw what I was doing here and she asked me if I wanted to take over that part of it and use that to help boost up what I was trying to do here. So she actually sent me my first couple hundred bracelets. So it started with bracelets. Bracelets became a big thing. I think we have bracelets in almost all 50 states. Well, the name Michael's Hope, Michael was my brother. Hope is something that we all need, especially in this time. But for us, Hope stands for heroin and opiate prevention and education. So the name of our organization, which we're a 501c3 nonprofit, the name is Michael's Hope Incorporated. Yeah, so at first it was just me with a dream and bracelets.
And anger.
And a lot of anger and confusion. I would say passion more than anger. let's start from the beginning with my brother.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
so
yeah.
When he was 17 years old, he worked for a company, a fish skinning machine. So it was a machine that would skin the fish. And his hand got sucked in, so what it did to the fish, it did to his hand. So a few hundred stitches later, a lot of pain. With pain comes pain prescriptions from the doctor's office. He was 29 when he passed away in 2012. I blame some pharmaceutical companies 110% for my brother's heroin addiction
and the doctors
too. The cause of his death. Some doctors you can blame for what they do because they know what they're doing, but I think what I'm learning as I get more and more involved in this is doctors are just uneducated. Yeah, so work-related injury leads to pain prescriptions run out, addiction has already set in, lawsuit money comes his way, he could afford the pain pills on the street or doctor shopping. You just go from doctor to doctor. And
they don't know that you've been to another doctor before?
Not then. Now they do. They pass this thing called iStop, so you no longer can doctor shop. Everything's electronic, so they know when you've been to a doctor. That's just recent. They didn't have that then, so it was very easy to doctor shop, and it was very easy to find doctors that you can pay some money to, and they just write you a prescription for whatever you wanted.
Really?
Yeah. He could pay for the pills. Money runs out. Can't afford pills anymore. Someone shows him a cheaper alternative, which is heroin. So that leads to his heroin addiction.
And that was all here in Mattituck?
That was all here in Mattituck. Between Mattituck and when he lived in Riverhead for a little while. A few days later, he ended up getting his first arrest for possession of drug paraphernalia and hypodermic needles. And typical heroin user paraphernalia in the car. That's what started it. That was the eye-opener for the family, and that's what started his, I think, real downward spiral.
Did he go to jail or anything after being arrested?
It was a big drug bust that he had gotten caught up in here on the North Fork in 2010 that he ended up going to jail for, and ended up altogether collectively about 18 months. He was supposed to do a lot more. He got out on a technicality.
Must have been terribly shocking for your family.
We were already full-blown known that he was a heroin addict at this point. We already knew that he was using because he's been in and out of institutions. And we brought him to rehabs. He got kicked out of rehabs. We brought him to rehab. He'd leave a rehab. We'd bring him to a detox. He'd leave a detox. He'd go to detox. He'd detox. He'd go to repoint. So the arrest really didn't really come into shock. What came into shock was seeing his face all over the news because it wasn't a small drug bust. So that was like the biggest shock. And then coming from the North Fork, we live in a small town. So everybody knows everybody, so everybody knows you. To me, it wasn't embarrassing. Good or bad, I'm proud of my family. You know, so whatever my brother went through, I was still proud of my brother because I knew my brother. And I couldn't judge him for the downfall he was going through at that time. He was suffering from a sickness. And
what
I still love
him. What about
your parents? I wouldn't say that they were embarrassed, but you know, it's tough. You know, they work locally. Everybody knows everybody's business out here. So it doesn't matter if the district attorney had labeled it as a multi-million dollar heroin ring. We knew that what my brother was doing and his involvement in that ring was just to support his habit. My brother was doing 42 bags of heroin a day.
Himself?
Himself.
And he wasn't dealing it, you mean?
That was what he was using, 42 bags of heroin.
How much time does that take to even do?
All day. You don't live no more. You're consumed by the drug. His girlfriend was also using about 40 bags of heroin a day.
How long does it take to use one?
I don't know. And at $2 a bag, that's $420 a day. Times that by two, if his girlfriend was using the same amount, that's $840 a day. Most of us don't even make that a week.
How did you know about 42 bags?
After his arrest, they were investigating him for about 8 months. They had him on wiretap. They had tapped his cell phone. So the detectives, after he was arrested, you know, he was already incarcerated. The detective showed up at my house. We had to sign some paperwork saying that we knew that we were on wiretap. The detectives just explained to us that every day that when they would start their job, so they'd wake up in the morning and know that they and every day we're going to investigate this case, and we're assigned to wiretap Michael Moffitt's cell phone, told me that every day when they would start their day, they would say a prayer that they would answer the phone because of how much heroin they were doing.
Oh, because in case they were dead, you mean?
Yeah, but they answered every time. You know, 42 bags of heroin a day didn't kill them.
And then?
So he gets incarcerated. Does 18 months, gets released on a technicality. Basically, get a phone call on a Wednesday saying, I'm coming home tomorrow, when he's not supposed to come home for a long time.
Were you prepared for that?
No, because he wasn't supposed to come home for a long time. At this point, he had left Riverhead Jail and was upstate. So my mom went to the train station and picked him up from upstate through Penn Station to Ronkonkoma. And then my buddy and I went and met him at in Riverhead at Modell's, went shopping. And everything seemed to be back on the swing of things. He was home. You know, it was early. I was scared because, you know, you can still use drugs in jail, so I don't really know if he was clean. I don't want him to come back to the same town where he was using, and I don't want him to come back to the same town that people give him the eye or the look because of what he was just wrapped up in only 18 months ago and what that can do to a person. So I was nervous for his sake more than mine, but he was home. So I got to embrace it and be excited and support him. So that's what we did. And we went back to being brothers like he had never left.
You're kind of checking him out all the time?
Of course, yeah. All the time, snooping through his phone. Yeah. So in my eyes, I didn't think that my brother would ever die. I was thinking, man, I don't want him to go back to prison. Mm. Like, he's home. Prison visits suck, you know, so like, let's keep him home. Came home in December, everything's good. He got a job with a local masonry, was making money, saving money, getting his license back, doing everything right. December, January, beginning of February, still nothing. And he came home from work on February 8th, 2012, and was talking to my parents at the, we have like an island in the kitchen, so he was talking to them at the counter. I heard him upstairs, I went upstairs, said, what's up, you know, how's work? He went and hopped in the shower, went back downstairs, knocked on the bathroom door, no answer. My first thing was, my brother's a heroin addict. He's behind the bathroom door, he's not answering. Something's not right. We didn't want to just kick the door down because we didn't know where he was laying. We didn't want to hit the door and the door smack him in the back of the head or something like that. So we were trying to like get in there as quickly as possible, but still being precautious at the same time. We picked the bathroom door, got it open. Bathtub was running and he was slumped over the bathtub. At that point, he was already blue.
So quickly, all of all this.
Quickly. So the night of February 8th, he was taken into the hospital, and then 3 days in the ICU, 9th, 10th, 11th, 3 days in the ICU, and then that's when we decided to, with a lot of studying and tests, that, you know, there was no coming back out of this, that we should turn the machine off. And
you were all sort of guided by the science of it? I mean, it was not an emotional or religious kind of decision?
No, because if you were going off emotions, then you would have done what, you know, Whitney Houston's husband Bobby did with their daughter and would have kept him on a machine for 8 months. It would have been selfish for us to keep him on that machine for some hope that he was going to pull out of that. But even if he did pull out of it, he would have been brain dead. You would have been in a vegetative state. So let's take him off the breathing machine. And if it wasn't an easy decision to make. It was a hard decision because you have to say goodbye to somebody that you love. It was a harder decision to deal with the doctors on hounding you for organ donations.
Oh, they hound you?
Oh my gosh.
Really?
It's horrible. No parent should have to bury a child in the first place. So you have a family that's grieving over a child and doctors are coming in the room every 17 minutes asking if we have decided for him to be an organ donor. And I didn't know of this until that day in the hospital, that you can only take your organs if you die of brain damage. Lack of oxygen is the only way that they could take your organs. And this is what they explained. That doesn't damage the organs in any way. Right. If you're in a car accident, you get hit, most of your organs are going to be damaged. Mm-hmm. Whatever was affected by his drug use obviously was no good. But his lungs were good. His heart was good. His eyes were good. My brother was just talking to my mother about that a couple weeks before his overdose, and he never once said, I think that was a good idea, I think I should do that, or I wanted to do that. So it was very easy for me to tell the doctors no. I was so set on, this is not what he said he ever wanted, so, you know, leave us alone. We're going through a hard time.
How old were you then?
It was right before my 23rd birthday.
So now you're 27. Seven.
Just turned 27 in March. First about a year and a half, I was lost. I just had given up. I went through a lot, especially that first year and a half. I was just getting by, doing what I had to do to get by.
Paul Maffetone, co-founder of Michael's Hope, is talking about the heroin epidemic here on the North Fork. This is Hazel Khan and North Fork Works on WPKN Radio.
Why don't we go back to Michael's Hope? So can you talk about that and what you did?
I had the passion, I had the motivation. I didn't have the courage to take that leap to actually make it something that you can do. So on October 26, 2015, I met up with and we grabbed dinner with who is now my girlfriend,
Christina. Well, you didn't know her before?
We had met a year prior and we had gone a year without, you know, seeing or talking, and then we had met back up in October and grabbed dinner. We were discussing things over dinner about what it is that I was doing with these bracelets and where my vision was. You know, I was like, oh, this is what I'm doing. And she was very into, excited to hear about what I've been doing for the last year. And you know, I was telling her, she felt that passion that I did. And she was like, you know, I think you really can do something. You know, I think we can do something. Like, we should do this. So it was all gung-ho from there, from October 26th. We established nonprofit status on February 2nd, 2016.
I think you've talked about some of these things, but some of the words that I took from your, I think it must have been your website, that you have a duty to be proactive.
Yes, we strongly believe in the fact of being proactive instead of reacting. We would like everybody to start being proactive. And we need to start prevention and education to the younger generations before they get to the age where they get involved in a high school party or an injury where it leads to pain pills.
So what age do you think you can start communicating?
We get this question all the time, and honestly, we can go into any grade. If you want us to talk to second graders or third graders, we most definitely can. And what we explain is that we're not going to go into a second grade class and talk about substance abuse and drugs and alcohol. Second grader's not going to understand that. But what you can talk to a second and third grader is about feelings. Because it's at that point where maybe you start realizing that you feel like you don't fit in. Or you're starting to feel sad. Or maybe you have problems at home and you're starting to get affected by them in third grade, fourth grade. It's a feeling inside of you that if you ask most people that have gotten involved in some type of substance abuse, that substance had made them feel better of something that they felt on the inside. Whether they knew they felt this way or not on the inside. Most of the time starts with that gut feeling. So you can talk to a second, third, fourth grader about feelings and let them know that, hey, more of us suffer from these feelings than not, and it's okay to talk about them, whether it's your best friend, your counselor, your parents, whoever it is, it's okay to talk about them.
So that's the thing that's difficult to remember, that these are children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of struck me. They're children.
Yeah. And that's exactly what it comes down to, is it's an uninformed decision that could affect the rest of their life. I say this to all of the people that attend our events. This addiction, whether it's heroin, it's crack, alcohol, addiction is not an individual's disease. It's not just suffered by the individual. My brother didn't just suffer from addiction. My family suffered from brother's addiction. So it's not only just an individual's disease, and it's not just a family's disease. It's actually a full community disease. It stems from the addict, but it branches out to everybody in the community. And the reason why I say that is because my brother came home from prison. He was a heroin addict. He was looked at differently in the community. I had to love my brother. That's my brother. I'm going to love him no matter what. My family's going to love him no matter what. If the community maybe loved him the way that we could and can see past the fact that he was an addict, and understand that he suffered from a disease, maybe it would have been a different outcome. Maybe he would have felt better going to find new friends instead of going right back to the old friends. We need to learn how to start accepting addiction in our communities. It's not saying it's okay to use. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that when somebody comes home from treatment after doing 90 days, 90 days isn't long enough to change your life. What you come home to is what's going to ultimately affect what happens tomorrow. Whether you go back to using or you're going to stay on that straight path is what you come home to. And we need more people to be open-armed to people in recovery, because there's a lot of people in this world in recovery right now. You don't even know who's in recovery, but you go to the store and I'm sure there's at least two people at the local grocery store that are in recovery. Mm-hmm. There might be somebody that's in recovery for 40 years. It doesn't matter. He's still in recovery. He still suffers every day from his addiction. His or her addiction, like the person that's only been in recovery for 30 days, they still suffer exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Just one has learned a lot more along the way, but if, say, my brother came home from prison and wanted to go back to school and go to college, where is he going to live? Because there's no sober living on campuses.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to take someone that's in recovery and you're going to put them in a dorm mm-hmm. with somebody who's going to come home drunk on a Friday, on a Saturday mm-hmm. night, or someone that might be using cocaine in the living room or the dorm.
Mm-hmm.
But you got somebody in recovery right there.
Is it easy for you to get into school?
It's not easy to get into schools. We have three team members that go into the schools. Trevor, Samantha, and Jordan are our power speakers in the schools. They know exactly what they're doing. They're in recovery. They're former addicts. They're in long-term recovery. Jordan's got close to 6 years. Trevor is close to five. Samantha's coming up on 2.5, 3 years. You know, because their stories are powerful. They hit home. They know how to address the audience. Yeah. They just talk. Mm. And you know that somebody is good at what they do when you pack an auditorium with high schoolers and not one high schooler is looking down at their phone and they're paying attention. Mm. Yeah, we love going to schools.
Are they always receptive?
No. They'll say that they don't have the funds for us to come in. From February until June, we did 15 school districts, which is a lot mm-hmm. in a short amount of time.
And they're all over Long Island?
Yep, all the way from far Nassau County to Suffolk County. And we didn't collect a check from one school district. School districts now are starting to offer up as we come back into the new school season. That was a big thing. Schools say, oh, we can't afford you. We have no funding for you. And we said, that's fine. It's more important for us to talk to the kids and worry about making money. Then once we got past that hurdle, then it was the parents are going to be mad. Mm. Johnny's going to come home and go tell him about what he saw today. And parents are going to be calling school, why is my kid hearing about heroin in the school? Which is a big reason why we do these community events in a community first before we approach the school district. Because we get all the parents behind us. So now when we go into a school district and they say, well, the parents, and we go, okay, that's fine, because the whole PTA wants us in here. And the entire community thinks that it's a great idea that we come into the school. So now there's really no reason for us not to come in.
And then when you do have an event, it's always filled up?
Yeah, the kids have no choice.
It's
mandated assembly.
Mandated, yeah.
Yeah, and then once the school sees what we do, we usually get invited back.
So you said three of your team are in recovery. And yes. What about the fourth one is your girlfriend?
Yes, Christina. Not in recovery from drug addiction. She had a traumatic brain injury when she was younger. She was prescribed 42 different types of medication. And the doctors told her, you're going to be on medicine for the rest of your life. And she said, no, I'm not. She brings in to the table that there's other ways to go about things. She was able to, by a miracle, come out of that injury. Has some memory issues and can't remember her younger years, but is not on a single medication to this day because of a healthier alternative that she had gotten involved in, and she brings that to the table, and it's great.
That's very interesting. So this is a solid team. You think that you're going to stay together, or are they all going to go their separate ways?
It's funny you brought that up because, it's a discussion whether we stay together as a full team or no matter what happens, people decide to branch off and do different things or do their own thing. We'll always have each other's backs and we'll always be fighting the same fight together. Whether it's for the same name or not, it doesn't make a difference. We all know that being involved in this field is where we want to be.
Mm-hmm. You don't have any funding at the moment.
We get some funding off of our merchandise and the money that we bring in from donations from our events.
But are you actually applying for any grants?
We are so new in this that actually Christina and I have been looking to start classes, start really learning on what it is. It costs a lot of money to have somebody write a grant for you. So you're going to pay somebody to write a grant for you and you don't even know if you're going to get it. We'd rather learn how to do all these things ourselves because right now almost everything that we're doing is coming out of our pocket.
What would you do with funding that you can't do now?
One of the biggest things that we struggle with, it costs us a lot of money to go to these schools, but we don't ever want to charge a school.
You mean just transportation?
Yeah, pamphlets, business cards, all that. We also have scholarships with rehabs out of state. After doing an extensive screening process, we can send people to a 90-day treatment for free. But some people can't afford the plane, so that's where it would be our responsibility to take on paying for their plane ticket. Or each one of the facilities, one's in Texas, one's in Florida, has doctors that they work with outside to do a detox program. If the patient that we're sending down needs detox, we can send them to a detox first before they go into inpatient. And the detox program costs $200 per person. And like I said, sometimes we get these families and they can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And it puts us in a situation where it's like, all right, well, we can come out of our pocket. We got to get these people there.
You're all very young. You're all sort of in mid to something 20s.
Yep.
Yeah.
Early 30s and mid 20s.
One of the things you also said that I sort of was impressed by was you said, our only aim is to be helpful. Is that how you look at it?
We look at it like this. The day that we no longer have to do this is the day that we are successful.
Yeah.
We don't want to do this forever.
No, because that was the next question is, how do you know you're successful?
When I'm not sitting here talking to you about Michael's Hope and what we're doing currently, when I'm sitting here and having a conversation with you about what I did in the past with Michael's Hope, is how you know that we are a success.
Right.
Now, whether that comes in my timeline or, my kids take this over and they get it in their timeline, but we do Narcan trainings, which is a big thing. Christina and I actually became certified Narcan trainers. So now we can do the trainings ourselves. I carry a Narcan kit on me every day. Everyone on the team carries their Narcan kit with them every day. Now, being in this field, you know a lot of people in recovery, and you know a lot of people that are suffering from addiction. You hear too many stories of somebody at a red light that looks over and sees that somebody's overdosed or in a parking lot. This epidemic is too large right now to take the chance to not carry it. And it's free to take the class. And you walk out of our two-hour event with a kit that you could save a life. You can get two versions of it. You can get intramuscular, which is a needle, or you get intranasal. Mm-hmm. The heroin epidemic that we're facing now makes the crack epidemic look tiny because heroin is everywhere. It's in your Hamptons. It's in Mastic. It's in Bedford-Stuyvesant. It's in Southold. It's in Hartford. You know, it's everywhere. And what I hear is that it's easier to find heroin than it is marijuana nowadays.
So what makes it so easy or so popular?
This has been going on since the early 2000s when they started pushing these prescriptions really hardcore, since it's just now catching up to us.
So the pharmaceutical companies created the market for the
dealers. Absolutely.
Do you sometimes get discouraged? Or what keeps your optimism up if you don't get discouraged?
I get discouraged with funds. That's it, honestly. We're talking about placing an order. You know, we have an event coming up and a convention coming up that we are doing. And we got to place order for shirts. And we're like, where are we getting the money from for these shirts? You know, we bought business cards and things like that. That's the only thing that we get really discouraged or frustrated by.
Perhaps you should be more aggressive about asking for donations.
That's what it has to come down to, is being more without pushing people away with it. We don't do this for money, so it's hard for us to look at it and be like, we need money. But it's like, it comes down to it, and it's like, we need money.
Yeah,
it's the only thing that discourages any of us. Other than that, we're all put on this earth for a reason. We all have a purpose. We just got lucky that the five of us know what our purpose is, and that was to help people. And then it just so happens that we were put on this path to understand how to help people. My brother's last gift to me was to show me what it was that I was supposed to do and where I was supposed to help, and that's in substance abuse.
So you feel very sure of that?
Yeah, absolutely, 110%.
Why don't you tell our listeners how they can, A, go to your website and your Facebook, and also what kinds of things they can buy? Because as I've been looking at I Hate Heroin all the time we've been sitting talking, on your wrist things and your
bracelets.
Your cap and your t-shirt, so I get it.
Yeah. Our website is michaelshope.net.
Mm-hmm.
Our Facebook page, Michael's Hope, or you can just type in the URL, facebook.com/wehateheroin631. Mm-hmm. Remember, heroin is spelled H-E-R-O-I-N. We're on Instagram, at Michael's Hope. We have two different types of t-shirts and hoodies. The front of them say, I hate heroin, with a giant red X through the heroin. We have snapback hats, and then we have rubber bracelets, and then we have bumper stickers. Yeah, you go around the website and it has there's a little merchandise section. There's even a donation section on the website.
Okay.
Yeah, funding is definitely something that helps us big time.
So Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking about Michael's Hope and everything that you do. So thank you.
Thank you.
You heard Paul Maffetone, co-founder of Michael's Hope, talking about the heroin epidemic here on the North Fork. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of every month at 7:30 p.m. All North Fork Works programs are produced by Tony Ernst and archived as podcasts on hazelkahn.com.